You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
In India, I met farmers whose crops have been literally washed away by historic flooding. In America, I have witnessed unprecedented droughts in California. In Greenland and in the Arctic, I was astonished to see that ancient glaciers are rapidly disappearing, well ahead of scientific predictions. All that I have seen and learned on my journey has absolutely terrified me.
So the question now is whether we will have the courage to act before it's too late. And how we answer will have a profound impact on the world that we leave behind, not just to you, but to your children and to your grandchildren. As a president, as a father, and as an American, I'm here to say we need to act.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is our new format. Hello in Florida, Angie.
Hello, Chris in New Zealand.
Yes, we are the other side of the planet, but this is the new segment of the podcast that Angie and I have been talking about a while doing, and it's just kind of a roundup, you know, two scientists talking about, you know, the week in conservation, news from around the world. We are going to see how it goes, you know, as we do this. I'm sure it's going to mature over the next few weeks as we kind of find our groove with it. We are going to tell you that we will definitely keep releasing episodes on new animals each week. We are trying to line up as many interviews as we can and release those on our Thursdays. And then we just thought, you know, there's always so much stuff that Angie and I pass back and forth. But, you know, my wife passes stuff to me on Facebook. I know John passes stuff to Angie. You know, there's so many stories each week. It's just been so overwhelming to try to cover it all. So we thought, you know, let's just do a weekly wrap up and just kind of say, okay, this is the week in conservation. This is what we've seen in the news, and just go from there and see how it goes.
So put your seatbelts on, folks. It might be a bumpy ride.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's easy because, you know, just think back to our first episode, Angie. We sat, you know, in my office way long ago in Florida.
I was sweating buckets, shaking, all nervous.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a little rough in the beginning, but I think this, you know, we found our groove with the animals, and I think we're going to find our groove.
Well, we found our groove, but hopefully our audience
we'll
does too, right?
Yeah. We're getting better. We're getting better, right?
Yes.
No, so this, you know, it's just there's so much news each week, which is great. It's really great to see, but it's just there's nowhere out there where you can really talk about it or highlight it. So I thought this would be great for us to do.
Well, I've sure had fun finding what I wanted to talk about, all the new clips and reading, ingesting even more material than I thought was possible from just the normal podcast in itself. So it's really helping me be well-rounded, right?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the goal. And then you just want to stay tuned, because I think at the end, what we're going to do each week is just highlight a new species that's been discovered. And there's been a bunch in 1 week.
Yes. There's been a handful of species. I will give a little bit of a hint that I picked a species with a name that's near and dear to my heart. So
we'll see. We'll see who that is.
Spoiler, it's not my husband.
I was going to say, is it John? Was it the John Rhino they found?
No, or it's not the Alexander Salamander or the Zachary Peccary either.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's good. There you go.
Thanks.
Okay.
I'm drinking my coffee tonight, so I might be on fire.
But
none of those. So it's, you know, my fourth or fifth love in my life. So anyways, but back to the news, Chris, tell me what you found.
Yeah. I'll be excited to hear which one that is. So I just wanted to open up, you know, first, I don't know if you've seen it. Have you seen the new National Geographic cover this week?
I have not.
Okay. It's making the rounds of social media, and I'm actually looking at it right now, and I'll link to it and post it, but it is powerful, and a lot of people are really talking about it. And the title is Planet or Plastic, and it's a plastic bag floating. Have you seen it?
No, but I've seen some other, clearly there's lots of plastic stuff going around. Yeah. My husband tagged me in another post recently, but I don't think I've seen this one. So it's a bag.
So what it is, it looks like a glacier on top, but underneath the surface, like, you know, that famous picture of the glacier, like from underneath and above.
Yeah,
so it looks
beautiful.
Like that. But underneath, it's a plastic bag, and it's just the corner sticking out. So, again, this week in news, which is good. This is good, because this is a lot of what you and I have been talking about. You know, we just you've really hammered home the plastic message in the Blue Whales episode. So if you haven't heard that episode, please go listen to it.
Yeah, I get on a little bit of my soapbox, but
I think
in a good way.
but it really, amazing cover. I think we're making ground on the fight and the discussion that's happening, right?
Right, Chris. I mean, that's definitely, I did not see this. So, you'll please put that in the show notes or you'll have to send it my way. But I do feel, and just looking around, there's definitely more conversations about plastic, about potentially banning single use plastic items if possible. Yeah. And so hopefully people will vote with their dollar and try to find new solutions of not using as much plastic. I know we are in our family and we won't get into all that today, but there does seem to be a conversation. So
keep it up.
I think it's good. I think let's put the pressure on and hopefully too, Chris and I can keep sharing with you guys fun products that we either find or try that maybe seem to help, like the straw.
Right.
I forget what it's called, but the straw in a keychain that pops open and it's like a metal straw. So you bring your keys whenever you go out to eat, right? Cause maybe not all the time, but you usually drive there. And so little solutions, genius. There's probably a lot of cool inventions that kids could invent, for Shark Tank or for whatever to try to actually be a solution to this problem. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. So
it is. And it's the younger generation. I know we really hit it in the Snapping Turtle and other episodes that we've done, that educating our children, and they're educating us, you know. I know Xander was wagging his finger at you, you know, with those disposable.
Oh, yeah. I got totally busted for trying to put something in the trash that potentially could be recycled.
Right.
It was, it's called, I think it's called TerraCycle.
TerraCycle, so you have that's to it,
Yeah, you have to mail it. And so I was like, nah, I don't got time for this.
I know.
But anyway, but I got busted. And I now have a box of TerraCycle in my garage. And so send it away. I'll just send it away when I have a lot of it to make it, you know, worth my while.
Yeah.
So
that's great. And it's just, you know, again, the good news story, you know, this graphic is really powerful, but the discussion's there and we're having the discussion in the public. So that is really good. And that's really good for the animals of the planet.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So that's what I just wanted to open up with. You know, just people are doing great. Keep doing what you're doing. You know, people out there, just try to reduce your use of plastics. It's really helping. So what'd you find this week? That was just what I wanted to open with.
Well, you came in with a very philanthropic, grandiose moving, kind of depressing
But we're
story.
Going the right direction, you know?
We are going progress. The right direction. Yes. No, yes. Maybe not depression, but yeah. I came with a completely different angle and I wanted to actually tell you, Chris, that I kid you not, two nights after we got done recording the alligator snapping turtle episode where we discussed, not at length, but probably dork out a little bit about turtles and or certain reptiles such as alligators and crocodiles, the sex of their offspring can be determined by the temperature that the eggs incubate at.
I know.
So it's, yeah, so we dorked out about that for a long time and you and I went back and forth. And then I believe in the episode, I was like, I just want to know what gene controls.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You said it. Yeah.
Yeah. I can dork out a little bit about molecular mechanisms here and then. And I kid you not, 2 days later, I was sitting and scrolling and I saw, lo and behold, researchers out of Duke University and a university in China, they are on their way to crack the 50-year-old puzzle of how turtles become male, baby turtles become male or female.
No way.
Yeah, they found the gene. They found, or at least in a very important gene.
Right, right. 2 days after we record.
but it was funny. So I just thought that I could share that with you. And it's just always interesting. You and I know about this from doing scientific research, especially when you're dealing with physiology. Probably all research is like this, but especially with physiology and molecular mechanisms, it's always like, it's like a, I don't want to say linear. I almost more of like a spider web type puzzle where you find point A and that leads you to point B to point C to point D. These researchers basically, they found the gene and it's called KDM6B.
Okay.
And that's a gene that's helping in the embryo, basically turn the switch on of whether it's a male or a female it's like a biological switch necessarily in the DNA or the ATCs and Gs itself. As the main on switch, but it's actually a molecule, that affects how the genes are expressed.
Okay. Okay.
So those are that. So the genes aren't changing. So it's not like a girl turtle and a boy turtle. It's a totally different gene or anything. Right. It's whether the gene is being turned on or turned off by these epigenetic mechanisms. And so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a full answer, but at least it's there on the right direction.
So you found a little bit more than I did for those few hours.
Well, this was a passion question of mine this past week.
I know. All right, so here's a teaching moment. And this is something I always talked about in class in trying to explain epigenetics, you know, to college freshmen even, and not just grad students. Epigenetics is like the new field, new frontier, or it has been the last few years in genetic medicine. The way I always described epigenetics, and I can't believe I didn't even think about that with the turtles because it makes sense. It's environment.
It does, right?
Yeah,
of course.
Environmental influences on genes and gene expression. So really quickly, in 2 minutes or less, because it 60 seconds or less, it probably won't work. All right. They found epigenetics. They go back to during World War II. In Holland, during the Nazi occupation, towards the end of World War II, after the it's a great story.
I've heard Chris. I've heard this like a thousand times. So I'm gonna go get a cup of coffee, and you talk about the Dutch famine, and I'll
back. All right, listeners. And so during the Dutch famine, the Dutch famine. The Dutch people were starving because the Germans had no food, so they didn't bring any food into there, and kind of to punish them too for supporting the Allies, long story short.
And this is World War II, right?
Yes, so the 1940s, 1944. So the women that were pregnant in 1944 they were on a diet of like 500 calories a day. So they were starving, and their fetuses were starving. You know, after World War II, they went back to normal diets. They went up to like 2,500 calories a day because the Allies came in and fed them and all that stuff. Lots of spam for the Dutch.
Yum.
Now, those babies, after they were born, they had like small for gestational age and all these things. You know, didn't think anything of it in the 1940s. Well, in the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s, these children were now adults and they started having horrific medical issues, you know, heart disease, diabetes in greater numbers than the average population. They've gone back and looked at all this, and it founded the field of epigenetics, that women that were starved during pregnancy. So that is kind of what led to all this. And so, yeah, Angie's heard this spiel a million times.
But they weren't changing the genetic code, Chris. They were changing.
No, they were expressions. That's what I meant. Gene expression. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, expression of certain genes.
So the genes stay the same.
Yeah, with turtles.
So their A, T, C's, and G's, that stays the same. Your genes are the same.
Yeah.
It's just whether or not the genes are expressed or are not expressed. And there's definitely a lot of environmental cues, like nutrition, such as in the Dutch famine, or environmental toxins. Yeah. I looked at a lot in my – I didn't look at them, but I learned a lot about them in my graduate studies. And so these can basically increase – and it's probably one of the ways that does help us evolve quickly, right? And so this KDM6B gene and the epigenetics – that make this gene either be expressed or not expressed.
Right.
So really, really cool stuff. Science is awesome.
Yeah. And nature is awesome. Biology,
my God,
is awesome.
If you are still listening to us, if we like start after our epigenetics spiel, yes, hopefully, I guess you're in it to win it, right? Like us.
Yeah. No, it is. It's all, you know, again, it's taking multiple disciplines to come together to understand biology, you know, so the physiology, the biology, the husbandry, and the people in the field, the ecology, and the environment. It's all of these fields. So in endangered species research, in looking at, you know, protecting the health of the environment, it's taking all of these specialties. So we need the geneticists. We need the physiologists. We need the ecologists. You know, we even need the
conservationists. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. The conservationists, most of all. Yeah. So, yeah, that's fascinating, Angie. And you know, we try not to dork out too much for the listeners.
I wasn't even dorking out. I just wanted to be like, ha, I'm right. I knew there had to be a gene.
Yeah, you were right. You were right.
But I was kind of wrong because it's not really, it's a gene and epigenetics. So it's kind of the combination.
No, it's still awesome though. And that just came out this week.
It was full circle. I'm like, oh man, if only this article would have come out the other day.
Okay. So switching gears a little bit, and this is an article I read in Yale Environment 360. So again, I'm going to put on our webpage, there's going to be two tabs. There's the All Creatures tab, which is our interviews and our creatures, and there'll be a tab on just
That's our baby. I told Chris, I'm like, don't mess with my baby.
No, that's our baby. And then this will be the second tab at the top of the website that you can click on, and I'll put the show notes and links to these articles if you're interested. But this one, I just want to read the title. And it just came out yesterday. Well, yesterday for me, today for you, because it's May 18th here. It's still May 17th there for you.
Oh, so it's Endangered Species Day for you.
Oh, is that today? Or is that? Yeah, it is today.
Well, it's the 18th. Oh, it's not for me.
Oh, it is.
Because it's the 17th for me. Yeah.
Oh, I'm in the future. Oh, great. Happy Endangered Species Day.
It is. I think this is a great way to celebrate, like putting news out there.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. So the title of this is Conservation Conundrum: Is Focusing on a Single Species a Good Strategy? And what this article is talking about, and I found it pretty fascinating, is there some researchers are questioning, and I'm just reading the blurb on it. Some researchers are questioning the fundamental conservation concept that creating and managing protected areas for a single quote unquote umbrella species.
The big dog. Yeah.
Yeah. Benefits other non-charismatic species sharing the same habitat. And so this is by Richard Conniff, and it's really interesting article. Basically, it's a dissertation coming out of the University of Wyoming, but it's asking the question, is this the right strategy? Because you and I have talked about it. You use the Okapi as an example, right?
Oh, yeah.
In that World Heritage Site in the Congo, you have this protected area to protect the Okapi, but it also protects chimpanzees, frogs, insects, fruit bats is one we highlight. Leopards that are there, that area is protected, so it protects all those other species. So that's the idea of an umbrella species. You throw all this money and effort into protecting one, it's going to benefit many.
Yeah, it's always been kind of a side selling point of looking at the umbrella species. And then I think too, if you take them out, they're so involved in the food web too, that the trickle down could be pretty Catastrophic.
Yeah, I trickle up too. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, trickle up.
The leopard,
sure.
You know, yeah. I mean, for all the different animals. So, you know, it's an interesting article. It goes back and forth. You know, in this, they're looking at sage grouse in Wyoming, and they're basically what they argue is by protecting this sage grouse, you've cordoned off areas for that species, but it doesn't really benefit some of the other species that come in and out of that area. And so they're saying, yeah, that's great. You're protecting the sage grouse, but it's not protecting all these other animals because they go outside that area and they die or they get, you know, hit by a car or something like that.
Yeah, I think they bring up a really good point. And I mean, if it's a dissertation out of the University of Wyoming, I presume it's going to be pretty solid science. And that's what we always talk about is it's one thing just to think something. Oh, this will cause that. But it's another to actually investigate it and find evidence supporting your hypothesis. And so I'm sure these researchers are careful to say this maybe doesn't include every umbrella species because probably some might really protect a lot of the trickle down ones. But it really is interesting that you could over an umbrella species, you could overestimate all the other species you are potentially protecting and maybe leave some out.
Right. And I think the knee-jerk reaction as a conservation enthusiast is how I would describe myself. And I'd be like, oh, you know, anything negative on conservation, don't publish it, don't read this. But that's not the point, right? I mean,
that's called bias, Chris.
Yeah, or the knee-jerk reaction. A lot of people have knee-jerk reactions.
Oh, we all do. Yeah. We always think with your heart first, and then your brain sometimes follows, sometimes it doesn't.
Right. Depending on the topic. You really have to think about it and do your research and look at it. And they bring up a lot of good points. I think for the okapi, right? Just a quick example. Okapi, that's a huge area. So I think that is benefiting a lot. It's And this Tim Cairo, he's at the University of California at Davis. He's a conservation biologist, and he states an effective conservation shortcut of umbrella species, perhaps because most reserves were initially large and could encompass substantial populations.
A lot
of
background
species, right? It's when you, I think, in this study, they go and you're doing really isolated areas of sage grouse, that's not exactly going to have maybe an effect on the black-footed ferret, you know, or the bison. You know, there's no way that a sage grouse habitat is going to cover a bison. So they bring up a lot of good points. And again, in science, we need to debate this stuff. We need to talk about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the end goal is all the same, is to protect as many species as possible, probably with the least amount of money and the least amount of space. Seems to be like what the goal is. Yeah. But how do we best do that? How much area do these animals need? What species are important in the niche? And the best way to do that is through science. And I applaud these guys for putting this out there, even if they do get a little bit of critiques because it's not really what we want to hear. But in the same instance, it's looking, I think, at taking a closer look at the individual species too, because I would also I would suggest too, like, looking at a bird umbrella species is totally different than a hoofstock or, you know, a primate. And so more work needs to be done. Now, is there money for that research? Probably not.
I know.
Unfortunately.
But it's great. And we need to learn and we need to evolve and we need to get better at a lot of this stuff. So I just thought it was a fascinating article. And, you know, just something that you and I've talked about the last few months is just the use of umbrella species.
Now, Chris, speaking of umbrella species, especially large hoofstock species, my favorite, with horns, also my favorite. Exciting news out of Chad is that 6 rhinos from South Africa are going to be translocated to Chad, which is a country in north central Africa. This is very exciting because they've been extinct in Chad and North Central Africa for over 50 years. They were hunted to extinction, black rhinos, and now they're going to roam in the wild again. And just really exciting for the country of Chad and for all their for the park and the locals and the government officials.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I don't know if we have any new listeners out there. If you have not checked out our translocating rhinos interview with Miss Allison Kennedy Benson, please do that, because you'll learn.
She is amazing.
She did this for a job for a while, as a translocating rhinos from one country in Africa to the next. And just briefly for the listeners, South Africa has like the large majority of both black and white rhinos. I think they have around 18,000 white rhinos and about 2,000 black rhinos. And that's,
which is still not a lot.
Which is not a lot at all, but that's about 80, that's about 80% of the global population of these guys.
I know.
And so it's not the best idea, especially with all these poaching problems that are happening in South Africa, to keep them all in South Africa. And the areas where the national parks that they're living in, they do get crowded and there's competition. So
yeah, I would say overcrowding and disease, if a disease came in and wiped them out. So you really,
yeah. And so the goal is to translocate them to different countries where they might be safer. And so the park where these rhinos are being relocated in Chad, they've experienced dramatic decreases in poaching since 2010. And their local elephant population in this park in Chad is increasing for the first time in more than a decade. And they feel really excited about it because they have a lot of locals on board and they're doing a lot of education, and they're hopeful that this will serve as a catalyst for economic growth in tourism fields. And they moved four cows and two bulls. So
just listening to Allison talk about the whole process of that is just amazing. So, you know, that's still ongoing. I would say, like, why is this park in Chad so successful? And we need to implement those strategies.
Sure.
Like,
I think
globally.
Right. I think a lot of it is that, you know, they probably have a lot of locals involved and really understanding probably the economic impact it can have. I just think that, and historically, even for the own country's kind of pride and heritage, because the black rhino used to be found in 28 African countries, but it's now only in South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, and Kenya, while a couple countries like Zambia, where I know Allison used to work, where we saw her, and Botswana and Malawi are starting these small populations to see if they can build up.
Get them established.
Establish historic herds again. So, but it's just, I think it's a great way too that the countries are coming together in Africa to kind of take an initiative on this global crisis and saying, hey, you know, how can we, what's the best way to save these guys from poaching and from diseases and all these types of things? So for me, it's really, really hopeful. And of course, I know from Allison and seeing her work on some of these projects, they are monitored pretty closely. It's usually done like safely with a soft release. They'll supplement, feed them. They basically have to train them teach them how to find food, because the food's going to be a lot different in South Africa versus North Central. I'll be following this story out for a while because it's very exciting.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it just reminds me of what you were doing last week. I don't know if you're able to talk about it or not, but you had your arm up some rhinos last week, right?
Just one rhino, but yes, I was helping a conservation park that is wanting to breed their female white rhino, and they needed some of my expertise for ultrasounding. Yeah. And it was really a wonderful experience, and hopefully being able to help this species, help it repopulate itself. Because sometimes when they're under human care, they can have reproductive problems, and this happens to be an aged animal as well. So trying to figure out what's going on with her and her cycle is key in order to get her bred. So
And that was a proud moment for me to see that, because
I bet because seven or eight years ago, you were the one that taught me for hours and hours and hours on how to ultrasound a horse. And so all that blood, sweat, and tears finally paid off. It was it was like full circle.
And we made a difference in the world. Yay.
Well, we'll see. Hopefully. Yes. All you can do is try, right? All you can do is try.
Well, that's a good segue, because this week, there's been a lot of memes out there talking about zoos and aquariums, conservation centers, about how important they are. And there's actually a really good book that just came out this week. It's called The Ark and Beyond,
oh, yeah.
The Evolution of Zoos and Aquarium Conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to get this book. It was Chicago Press or something like that. I will definitely get this as soon as I can and read it and then report back to the listeners on it if they're interested in it. But it's just the evolution of zoos and aquariums. And it just, you know, you and I, the last few months, have really talked about this quite a bit. I have given a lot of thought, a lot of brain power to how zoos and aquariums have evolved. And, you know, it's not what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30, you know, 100 years ago. Zoos were horrific if you look back at it. You know, we look back at zoos, what they were, like the animals in cages, things like that. It was not okay. It was not okay. But zoos aren't that today. Accredited zoos are not that today. You should never go and go to a place where they have animals kept under really poor care. So, you know, the memes that are going around, and I'm just going to put this out there. These are the species that they've saved. We've covered quite a bit of them. There is the Przewalski horse, California condor, panda, black-footed ferret, animals that we've talked about or will talk about, Arabian oryx, the Caribbeanese frog, the bongo, the regent honeyeater bird, the Panamanian golden frog, which is a really poison dart frog. Amazing story on that one. Amazing, amazing how they've come in and rescued them because they were done. The there's river turtles, golden line tamarin.
Yeah, that's what I started my career on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. We covered red wolves, American kestrel, big important peregrine fun. Catball langur is supported by the Catball Langur Project in Catball Island is supported by the Leipzig Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
The Amur leopard. You know, just a list of species, it can go on and on, that they are fighting day in, day out to do these things. You know, you're at a conservation center.
Yeah.
Rhinos.
Yeah. I mean, the Guam rail is a bird that's extinct in the wild
yeah.
that is being propagated yeah. at accredited zoos and even being mm-hmm. Released on a different island that doesn't have the invasive species that hunted it to extinction. So, yeah, right. I mean, really just incredible work, and let alone the amount of money that they have donated to conservation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in
right.
the tens of millions of dollars annually. Probably,
yeah.
no.
And the researchers, yeah.
No, I think it's higher than that. I think, yeah.
It's hundreds. It's
yeah,
hundreds
I think
of
it's
millions.
200,
yeah, it's like 150 million.
I was going to say 216. That number pops out. I've got to yeah. get my numbers straight. Too busy trying to fib to people how old I am.
Yeah.
I get my numbers mixed up.
You still look young 20s. Eh?
Oh, thanks. You're too kind.
You and my wife. My wife looks
oh,
like
she
she's
looks
10.
Like she's 12. Seriously.
I don't know
how she does it. I need some.
She's got good genes.
She does.
Good genes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Good genes.
But yeah, let's just 200 million minimally annually.
Yeah.
Or I think this was 2016 that they have yeah. donated to conservation organizations and saving species in the wild. Nobody else can really say that. And so my challenge to the listeners out there is share some of this information with people that are perhaps naysayers.
Right.
That would be, cause I pick and choose my battles accordingly, but as a scientist and a passionate mm-hmm. zoo conservationist type person, I've started sharing some of these thoughts and these numbers, right? I'm a scientist, mm-hmm. so I'm more mm-hmm. of a person of numbers right. and actual results. I try to use my brain over my heart, which is often hard to do, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
yeah, no, share this information Chris puts up with somebody who may be a naysayer. And,
it's really in the, it's the younger generation under 40, I know, are the ones that are like, well, zoos are horrible. These animals should be in the wild. And you're like, yeah, that's ideal. But you talked about South Africa and the rhinos. There is no wild.
There is no
wild in South Africa.
Mm-mm.
No, there isn't. It's all, they're all game
right.
parks that are managed.
So then the,
that are for tourists.
Right. And so then
and
people
like
say,
that.
Well,
yeah.
put them in a sanctuary. And I think the misnomer with a sanctuary is that a lot of times the diseases and the medical treatment and the things that they get when they're in accredited zoos and aquariums are severely lacking in sanctuaries because sanctuaries are always, you yeah. know, they're not well funded either. And they're also not, financially necessarily stable, where part of the accreditation process in zoos and aquariums is looking at finances and being like, okay, this place can operate for the next 15 or 20 years or 30, you know, and they're being checked every 5 years, where sanctuaries don't necessarily have that option and they don't have the right tools.
And that is... That's a phenomenal point.
And there's plenty of sanctuaries out there that are doing great things. Yeah. So I don't want to, but those places are, a lot of those places are full and they're at capacity and they do have vets on staff and they do wonder, I'm not saying all sanctuaries, but it's just not as easy as like, oh, take them from a zoo and put them in a sanctuary. That's not always, first of all, there's probably not any availability. And second of all, if there is, like there's potentially things that are lacking in sanctuaries that are not lacking in, let alone the research and the dietitians.
Yeah. I mean, the scientists, the research scientists, like you said, the dietitians, the vet staff, the keeper staff, all of those things exist at these accredited zoos
and zoos do education. They do outreach, a lot of things that some of these, you know, smaller
sanctuaries can't.
Yeah. Or one or two man shows. And, you know, I guess I was talking with my husband the other night. Yeah, my husband and I were talking. It's like, you know, I wish every animal I could be in the wild, and that's the only place we could see it. For that sake, if that was possible, I would even be as bold to say, like, I wish there weren't zoos. But that is just so naive and unrealistic. It's you're not doing the animals any favors by even really going down that road. At this rate in the game. And I've been to Africa and I've been to Central America. I've been in the Amazon. And there's still a lot of wild places left. Don't get me wrong. And we need to protect them. But especially you can't take an animal that's been living under human care for X amount of years and throw them in the wild. That's just goofy.
And it's cruel. It's cruel.
It's cruel.
So we'll keep this story going. But, you know, my final message is if you do have concerns, anything that animal husbandry, ask the
Absolutely.
Keeper, ask the staff. They would love to talk to you about why they do things. Please don't. I have a great interview with Jim Winepress next week at the Seneca Park Zoo. He talks a lot about this stuff. Please, please. They want to talk to you. You know, ask us. Ask me and Angie. You know, we'll find the answers for you. So anyways, I just thought it was great to see that this week. You know, a lot of the species they've saved and are working hard to save.
Yes, definitely. Well, and hopefully that's the other thing too. I think, I'm hopeful that the zoos and aquariums will keep trying to share all these good stories, and they, you know, they historically haven't been very good at promoting themselves because they've been focusing on taking care of animals. And I think, I think they're obviously starting to realize that they are under attack, and so they're starting to be like, "Oh yeah, wait, now we do all this other great stuff." So hopefully, we'll be seeing and hearing more about it. Now there's like more webcams and you know all the animal cams and things like that too. And their websites are brilliant and very transparent. When animals pass away, they tell you why and they explain it.
But kind of like I think the format of this weekly roundup is where Angie and I can also just express some of our opinions because, you know, we're very scientific when we're doing our interviews and we're very scientific. We try to be when we're doing our facts with the animals. You know, we do go on harangues with plastics and things that are important, but, you know, I totally agree with you 100%. 100%.
But getting back to science, Chris,
yes.
And conservation.
Okay.
So a really cool story is that, so researchers are hopeful that they could potentially protect elephants from poachers. Mm-hmm. By listening to them with earthquake monitoring tools.
Ooh, my babies.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I know this one's for you, Chris. So a study recently published in the journal Current Biology with researchers out of the University of Oxford and Bristol are basically investigating using the vibrations that elephants create during their feet and through vocalizations as a potential tool to protect them from the poachers. And so what they do is they're conducting a study and they're using devices. They're called geophones. And they're putting them near wild elephants in Kenya. And they're like seismographs. Geophones can convert the vibrations that the elephants make into measurable electronic signals out in the field. And so the researchers are hypothesizing that with using these geophones that they can triangulate where different seismic forces are coming from or AKA where the elephant is.
Oh, wow.
And so because a lot of these elephants are in big parks, and it has been recently, well, not recently, but in the past five to 10 years or so, it's been determined that elephants can communicate through different vibrations.
Low frequencies.
They think it's either coming through perhaps their feet or maybe their inner ear. So they're not totally sure about that, but they know that they make it, and they know that they travel through the ground a lot further than their trumpeting sounds in the air.
And so it's interesting. Jesse, my interview with Jesse, he talks about the okapi and the babies and mamas, and they use low frequency that we can't hear.
Oh, cool.
Vibrations. And so the low frequency can go through the ground or through some of the environment, where a high frequency bounces back. So we kind of talk about that in the interview. But yeah, so elephants do use that to communicate. They have low frequency bellows and stuff that.
Well, the researchers used computer models to show that the vibrations they recorded could be distinguished from 4 miles away under optimal conditions. Whereas like a trumpeting vibration, one that's going through the air, is maybe only two miles. So
yeah, it's not hundreds. It's a few more kilometers.
Yeah.
It goes far. It goes pretty far.
Yeah. And researchers too are still trying to decode whether this is, they think it's probably either to, obviously to communicate with other elephants, but whether it's to communicate about potential threats or breeding, right? For breeding, like, hey, where are you? Yeah. You know, type of messages. And so, but yeah, to me, it's just an amazing way that scientists that are studying like seismology they were like, hey, we could use this to like help protect elephants from poachers and trying to figure where they are, you know, where they're at nighttime. And so then that way, you know, the whole goal too, is then the people that are protecting them could be more in the area without disturbing the animals. So
where they know.
I think it's a really,
that's cool, a really cool
potential. And I just think it's interesting how, like you said, different disciplines come together.
Right. So just to kind of wrap up this week, it's, you know, a new format. We're going to kind of see how it goes, and let us know any stories that you'd be interested in hearing from. Angie and I will kind of do that. We just kind of want to highlight some of the bigger things we saw this week. We'll try this again next week and throw it out there and see what you think. As promised, the new species I found this week is a new bat in Africa, in Mozambique, okay, is the Gorgongosa horseshoe bat. And this thing has, they just discovered it this week. It has this incredible face that looks like a horseshoe. And I think it helps, you know, they use obviously echolocation to find their food and stuff like that. So that was just announced this week. That was one I found. I was like, wow. Because I'm really falling in love with bats.
I was actually, I'm going to try to get another interview with a bat specialist here at Luby in Florida. How did they miss a bat? Like, how are they just now finding it?
Exactly. Because these things, not only, you know, I guess forest degradation, but it's people out there looking for them, right? And never discovering new things. So will we find some megafauna the size of, you know, a cow or a horse? Probably not. I think we've classified most of them. Are we finding small mammals? Yes. You know, you see it in the news all the time, especially in some of these remote islands, like in the South Pacific near me. They just found like a new, it's not the Barbarossa, but it's like one of those pigs. Mm-hmm. You know, that was just discovered like a couple months ago. So there are probably some mammals like that still running around. Maybe something in the ocean we haven't quite found yet.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as far as big, but all these small ones, God, I mean, how many insects have been discovered this week? I don't know. What'd you find?
Well, sure. And, there's a couple species I want to highlight, but, since we'll be hopefully doing this again soon, I will go for the species of the week that caught my eye, which is an insect, water beetle. But that's not what caught my eye. what caught my eye and turned my fancy a little bit was that citizen scientists that found this water beetle, they discovered it in pristine, Malawi Basin in in Borneo. They wanted to name it after my buddy Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He's not my buddy yet, but I figure if you put something out there in the universe, it might come true. He's my conservation crush, which my husband fully endorses. So they are, you know, a lot of times people will name new species after like who discovered it, or sometimes Hollywood people or whatever, because maybe they look like a certain person or something. But this one was Foley, named, it's Grovellinus Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, good job. Good job. Clap. Thank you.
All
right. That's good.
Yeah, this was solely based on the fact that he is a rock star conservationist and his foundation, the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, and its efforts towards biodiversity preservation. And if you haven't gone to their website, check them out. They do radical stuff. He deserves, in my opinion, definitely to have a water beetle named after him, if not even my child. Just kidding.
Yeah, I know. All right. Well, that does it for this week's roundup. We will be back on Tuesday with a new species. We have a great interview with Jim Winepress next Thursday, talking naked mole rats and other things. And then we'll be back next Friday with this and see how it goes. So take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.